On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. We'll start with a look at this year's UN Conference on Climate Change. Parties hope to leave with a new accord to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Senior producer Rob Sivek talks with Bill McKibben, a leading environmental activist and the author of The End of Nature, about what's at stake for the U.S. and for the 160 other countries who'll be attending. Then, more than 30 neighborhood churches have been working to shape the path of Sandtown Winchester, especially as it looks to its future in the wake of the April unrest. I'll speak with Pastor Amelia Harris of Newborn Community of Faith Church and Lewis Wilson of New Song Community Church. Plus, the holidays will soon be upon us. That means a chance to dress up for the festivities. Society and Style reporter for the Baltimore Sun, Sloan Brown, offers her thoughts on the daunting task of looking good. And a Baltimore story from Gil Sandler. First, the news.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm senior producer Rob Sivek. 1 week after the deadly attacks in Paris by ISIS terrorists, security remains very tight in the City of Light, as residents and visitors struggle to regain a sense of normalcy. People still on edge from last Friday's violence have been encouraged to return to their routines, but only to a point. Two major marches through the streets of Paris plan to coincide with the UN-sponsored climate conference, convening there at the end of this month, have been canceled by French authorities because of security concerns. But officials say the 12-day climate conference itself will go on. France will be hosting delegates from more than 160 countries. They're gathering for another round of talks whose goal is nothing less than pulling the world back from the brink of environmental catastrophe. Negotiators hope to reach an accord that, for the first time in the more than 20 years of these talks, would hold countries more accountable if they fall short of commitments to cut their emissions of planet-warming carbon dioxide and other so-called greenhouse gases. With me this morning to talk about what's at stake in the Paris climate talks is Bill McKibben. He's an environmental activist, journalist, and author of many books, including The End of Nature, the prescient 1989 wake-up call about our global environmental crisis. He's also the co-founder of 350.org, an international network that combats global warming through grassroots political action. Mr. McKibben is on the phone with me from Middlebury, Vermont. Bill, thanks for joining us on Maryland Morning.
Rob, what a pleasure to be with you.
Many environmental activists have been expressing hope that this climate conference in Paris could break new ground with an accord that would provide greater incentives for all countries to curb their greenhouse gas emissions. Are they right to be hopeful?
Well, I think the way to look at this Paris conference, Rob, is less as the game than as the scoreboard. You'll recall there was a big climate conference 6 years ago in the Danish city of Copenhagen, and that ended in complete failure, utter fiasco. The papers called it the worst diplomatic failure since Munich. This will go much better, or at least somewhat better, and the reason is that in the intervening 5 years, a real movement has sprung up all over the world. Barack Obama and other world leaders could come back empty-handed from Copenhagen and face no real trouble as a result. No one really held their feet to the fire. But that's no longer the case. There's now a strong movement all over the planet, a movement that's done things like block the Keystone Pipeline or end plans for the largest coal mine on Earth in Australia, and on and on and on. And as a result, world leaders will produce something. Now, world leaders are still also bedeviled all the time by the power of the fossil fuel industry, so they won't produce anything near what we need. If coming out of Copenhagen, the world was set on a path to about a 5 degree Celsius, 8 or 9 degree Fahrenheit temperature increase this century, coming out of Paris, it looks like we'll be on a trajectory for about a 3.5 degree increase in temperature, 6 or 7 degrees Fahrenheit. That's better than 5 degrees, but it's far more than any scientist thinks the planet can warm. So like any scoreboard, these talks will tell us how much we're catching up and how much work we still have to do.
Right. The goal in all of these talks, or based on climate science, has been that we need to reach some kind of equilibrium at 2 degrees, and that we should not go beyond that.
It feels increasingly like even that is a not very wise goal, because the Earth is reacting much more to the temperature increases we've already seen than we thought. As of this year, the Earth has warmed more than by just about exactly 1 degree Celsius. And that's been enough to melt most of the summer sea ice in the Arctic, and the ocean is about 30% more acidic than it was 40 years ago, and we're seeing huge increases in weather extremes. We're probably idiots to find out what 2 degrees will do, but we're going to come pretty close even if we do absolutely everything right at this point. There's a lot of momentum, unfortunately, in this system.
So is there a set of specific achievements that need to happen in Paris for you to consider the climate conference to be a success?
We already know most of what countries are going to pledge and do. And there won't be a treaty that comes out of Paris, any kind of binding accord. That's because the rest of the world has had to change their diplomatic processes to reflect the complete dysfunction of the American political system. Everybody around the world is well aware that no sane climate treaty would ever get 2/3 of the votes in the U.S. Senate, that the fossil fuel industry owns our Congress to the degree that would be impossible. So instead of a treaty, there's this sort of series of pledges by various countries to do various amounts. And that's not as good as a treaty, obviously. It means that the pledges that the U.S. made could be repudiated should, Donald Trump or someone who doesn't believe in climate change take over the White House. But they're a start. And the two things that I think remain to be decided at Paris are the level of support that there will be for helping poor countries leapfrog the fossil fuel age and go directly to renewable energy. That's now possible. You know, the other thing that's happened since Copenhagen is the price of a solar panel has fallen by about 80%. And so if we set our minds to it, we could take most of the world out of the dark and do it cleanly and do it fast. But that will require some money. We'll see what the world comes up with in Paris. The other thing in Paris that will be important is whether or not there's some mechanism in these agreements to trigger, kind of ratchet up the levels of commitment as the science gets darker around climate change. And I'm dubious whether there'll be a solid mechanism to do that or not. I think that this is one area where the fossil fuel industry may still be strong enough to triumph.
On 88.1 WYPR, this is Marilyn Morning, and I'm senior producer Rob Sivak, talking about the upcoming climate talks in Paris with Bill McKibben, an environmental activist, author, and co-founder of the environmental group 350.org. Bill, when President Barack Obama recently observed that, while announcing the cancellation of the XL oil pipeline project, that we need to accept that a lot of the remaining oil underground should not be drilled and refined. That seemed a remarkable moment. And I wondered if you could describe your reactions to a significant statement like that about our policy toward renewable energy and really changing the paradigm on our relationship with fossil fuels. Was that significant to you?
I think you picked just the right moment out of that speech, Rob, and what it highlights is the amazing work of people around the world and around the region over the last 5 years. Groups in your area, like the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and people like Mike Tidwell, who have worked with astonishing power to make this case. The Keystone Pipeline may have been the first of these fights, but there are now thousands upon thousands of places, including places like Cove Point, where they're fighting LNG plants and things, all over the world, where people have come to the scientific understanding that most of the carbon that we know about needs to stay underground. Most of the coal and gas and oil will never be able to be dug up and burned. That's no longer, you know, just me saying that. That's the governor of the Bank of England speaking to the insurance industry at Lloyd's of London 2 or 3 weeks ago. That's the World Bank. That's IMF. The numbers are just you know, I mean, the math is relatively simple. If we burn up what the fossil fuel industry wants us to, if they dig it up and sell it and we burn it, then the planet goes way, way beyond any of the bounds that any scientist think is even remotely safe.
There's so many challenges, though, to getting a handle on the on this fossil fuel and our carbon emissions. You know, countries with the highest rates of industrial emissions, the United States, China, the European nations, India, they all seem to have very different roads to travel to get to a more sustainable kind of carbon economy. Can you size up what the prospects are for all of these various actors meeting in the same place?
Well, everybody starts, as you say, at very different places, but everyone's converging on the same set of answers because they're so obvious. You know, for the rich parts of the world, we need a lot of conservation because we waste a lot of energy, but then we need sun, and we need wind, and we need storage of electricity. We need to electrify our economies. We need to provide that electricity from the sun and the wind, and then we need to be able to store it for when the sun and the wind aren't producing. And all those things, you know, are happening now. The cost of batteries is falling almost as fast as the cost of solar panels. The world is primed to do the right thing. We're able to do it if we can break the power of the fossil fuel industry, which wants to keep us using their products for another generation or two past the point where it'll break the planet. We know now the level of the kind of despicableness of this industry. Documents published in the LA Times and elsewhere over the last 6 weeks demonstrate that the biggest of these companies, Exxon, knew everything there was to know about climate change 25 years ago. And instead of just saying that so we could have ended this faux, pretend, phony debate, they instead spent millions upon millions of dollars setting up phony front groups and hiring old tobacco scientists and things in order to spread deception and disinformation and confusion. Probably the greatest corporate scandal of all time. That's what we're trying to overcome.
Bill McKibben is a leading activist, co-founder of the environmental group 350.org, and author of the 1989 classic of environmental activism, The End of Nature. The United Nations-sponsored climate talks begin at Le Bourget outside Paris on November 30th and run through December 11th. Bill McKibben, thank you again for joining us.
Rob, thank you very much.
We've got more information about the UN Climate Change Conference and about Bill McKibben on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Rob Sivak. Ahead on Maryland Morning, we revisit a conversation with two religious leaders working in West Baltimore's Sandtown Winchester neighborhood. Stay with us here on 88.1.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
When riots broke out around Baltimore last spring following the death of Freddie Gray, many people looked to local clergy for answers about how to address the root causes of problems in the African-American urban community. At one time, there were more than 50 churches in Sandtown Winchester, the Baltimore neighborhood which became the focal point of attention following the violence in April. There are now more than 30 churches, which still represents a high concentration in the 72-square-block area that Sandtown encompasses. What can and should these churches be doing in this neighborhood, which has long struggled with high unemployment, poverty, addiction, and crime? Last June, I spoke with two pastors who are doing a lot. Pastor Amelia Harris is the co-pastor of the Newborn Community of Faith Church. She has lived and worked in Sandtown with her husband, Elder C.W. Harris, for more than 30 years. Dr. Lewis Wilson came to Sandtown from Chicago in January, accepting the call to lead the New Song Community Church. Our conversation was part of Living Questions, our monthly series that examines the role of religion in the public sphere. We're producing the series in cooperation with the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies. Pastor Amelia Harris first came to Sandtown as a teenager in the years before the riots that tore apart the city in 1968. She talked about how the church was always a fundament of the neighborhood.
When I think about as a teenager, churches always represented not just the place of worship, but actually a place where families, we would all go together. So when the neighbors saw you walking to a particular church, it meant something. And after the riots in 68, in the beginning, it still kept everyone coming. But as years began to progress, you started seeing the family split. So you may see the mother, or you might just see the children going to Sunday school. And what I've noticed since that time is that we're really working hard at bringing that whole family back together, whether it just be a single mom and children or a single dad and children or whoever, but the whole family going, because I believe that they understand the importance of being in a place where they can find comfort and consolation.
And before the 1968 riots, what was Sandtown like as a community? Now, unfortunately, we do, you know, associate it with the blight and the abandoned homes and the poverty and the various problems that, you know, accompany all of those kinds of things. What was it like back in the 60s?
Back in the 60s, it was a thriving area. It encompassed all of the musicians, the singers. You hear them talk about Stevie Wonder, the Supremes. And I remember as a young girl growing up that they would come to the Royal Theater, which was on Pennsylvania Avenue.
Sure.
And that was the place that, as African Americans, we could come and be a part of the entertainment world. And so all of your singers would just stop there and flood there. And it was at night. I remember my father driving down Pennsylvania Avenue, and it was lit up with lights, and it had stores, and he would take us in and buy all of the girls' dresses, and you could only get one kind of shoes, and that was Buster Brown's. And so it was thriving with people. Everybody knew each other, mm-hmm. And so you weren't a stranger.
Sure. You know, and if it was thriving then, perhaps it can be made to thrive again. Pastor Wilson, you came here from Chicago in January, so you've had a perspective of about 6 months. What are your impressions, both of the neighborhood now and its potential?
I think there's a lot of potential. I try to make a little bit of a habit of studying urbanization and the forces that are against it, or forces that can even help it. I come from the south side of Chicago, a community much like Sandtown, Inglewood, where they do a lot of shooting and murders, and there's a lot of addiction and drug use and selling. I think there's a lot of hope for the community. I think one of the things, from my perspective, that we need to focus in on is men.
Men.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times we sort of ignore our men. We'll do things for our children sometimes. I was at a meeting the other day, and I understand why people want to do that. And so there's a push to employ our youth this summer, and I think that ought to be done. But there's a corollary factor that I think sometimes people don't consider. What about the man who's on the corner and now his son or his daughter has a job, but he doesn't? How does that make that man feel? What about the pain of this man? And we had a big affair Saturday, and you could see men standing on the periphery, you know, just looking in at something else that was going on with some of their, probably their kids, you know, or maybe their girlfriends or their wives even. And so, but I still think there's hope. I think it takes time. I think you have to build relationships with people. It's not just a program or a project. It's actually spending time and getting to know people one-on-one. And that's a very intensive kind of thing. My wife and I both, we spend time, you know, I'll just walk around the street sometimes, you know, and just meeting people. And sometimes I'll wave at everybody, and sometimes nobody waves, but now they're starting to wave. Oh, that's, hey, Pastor, you know, he's like, well, I don't know who that guy is. So, but I'm starting to have a presence. And to me, it starts there. You know, you don't force yourself on people. You slowly take time to earn the right to speak into somebody's life. And I think if you believe that, I think we can see substantive change down the road.
You're listening to Living Questions here on Maryland Morning, our monthly series on religion in the public sphere. Today, we're talking about the ministries of two churches in Sandtown, Winchester, Newborn Community of Faith and the New Song Community Church with their pastors, Pastor Amelia Harris and Pastor Lewis Wilson. I'm Tom Hall. Pastor Harris, there is an organization that I guess was sort of dormant for a little while, which has recently been revived following the events in April, called Clergy United for Transformation of Sandtown. Talk about the work that that group is doing. I know you're involved with that. And what's the mission, and where does that stand, given what happened?
Well, CUTS was originally started under the leadership of Father Damien Nepal. He was the rector for St. Gregory the Great over on Baker Street and Gilmore. And he really worked in trying to bring all of the pastors, whether they had the large facilities or some with the storefronts. It was his aim and mission to bring the pastors together that they might be able to talk around the justice issues, talk around how we could help one another. And what happened was when Father Damien passed away, it really hurt the community because it was like a beacon of light there at St. Gregory. And so what those of us who knew and were a part of it, especially Elder Harris, said, we need to come back and let's do the things that we have been working so hard to bring about a unity of the churches, regardless of whatever background that you are. Show people that we as one nation, one community under God can work together, because there's a saying that we can't, you know, we stick with our own kind. And so we've come back even stronger because we've actually been knocking at doors saying, come, you know, you might be a new pastor on the block, but we want to embrace you and say we're here to help in whatever capacity that we can help you. Because a lot of time, if you're just starting from ground zero and you're new, most of the community, they've picked their churches, and so that's where they attend. And we want them to know you're welcome.
Mm-hmm. And Pastor Wilson, both you and Pastor Harris have a very holistic approach to addressing the problems in your community. Your umbrella organization is called the New Song Urban Ministries. Pastor Harris has the Newborn Holistic Ministries. I mean, the name states quite frankly and purposefully that you're looking at all of the needs, the spiritual needs as well as the material and physical needs of your congregants. Mm-hmm. You know, for years, I mean, ever since President George H.W. Bush and his 1,000 Points of Light, particularly people on the political right, have advocated for churches and nonprofits to take over the role that some government social services agencies currently have. I wonder if there's just too much pressure on churches. I mean, you've got a building to run. You've got lights to keep on. You know, you've got ice to shovel off the sidewalks on Sunday. You've got a lot of things to take care of on a day-to-day basis. Do you feel a lot of pressure on institutions like yours, churches in particular, to pick up the slack where government or other agencies have let the ball drop?
I would probably say, first of all, that the Bible says he'll put no more on us than what we can bear. And so therefore, if there are issues and concerns that our community needs to confront, I actually believe the community itself has the wherewithal to do that. And let me explain that. I really go right back to Genesis, where it says that God says he blessed them and says subdue, rule, fill, multiply, and increase the earth. And I believe that every man, woman, and child has a capacity to be productive and has a desire to be productive. So it's not so much to me identifying all felt needs, it's peeling back the layers that stop that person from being all that God has designed them to be. There are people right there in Sandtown who have the wherewithal to change Sandtown. And I think we have to start there. That doesn't mean that we won't solicit help from government agencies or state agencies or nonprofits, but it means that we go with the idea that we're coming to help a people be what God has already equipped them to be, as opposed to us coming in to make them to be something. They're already there, you know, so love them and all their gifts and all their talents and all their skills and all their values. And I think you'll see a substantive change.
Pastor Harris, the events in Ferguson and Staten Island and Cleveland clearly had an impact on our community's reaction to the death of Freddie Gray while he was in police custody. What do you think the impact of the tragedy in Charleston will be on Baltimore?
I feel as though the impact that has taken place just by the family members being in that courtroom, looking at the individual who committed the crime and the killings, to be able to say that we forgive you, may God have mercy. I think for the church world, those of us that understand that type of forgiveness, I feel like it intensifies my teachings that yes, that is the way we've been taught. We hurt, yes. We will miss any loved one that goes away from us, we miss them. But for those of us that have been brought up under those teachings, then it just solidifies. I keep thinking that the scripture says, vengeance is mine, says the Lord, I'll repay. So, you know, you have these two groups and you're hoping that we can keep from repeating what we've just experienced.
Pastor Amelia Harris is the co-pastor of the Newborn Community of Faith Church. Pastor Lewis Wilson is the pastor of the New Song Community Church. We spoke in June. There are many social ministries in the churches in Sandtown, Winchester. They include programs like Martha's Place, Strength to Love, Jubilee Arts, New Song Community Learning Center, the Winchester Street Potter's House, and the Baltimore Food and Faith Program. If you'd like to get involved or learn more about these programs, we've got links to information on our website, wypr.org/livingquestions. You've been listening to a rebroadcast of one of the segments in our series, Living Questions, produced by WYPR in partnership with the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies, examining the role of religion in the public sphere. You can hear all of the conversations in our Living Questions series when you visit our website. Again, come to wypr.org/livingquestions. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more ahead on Maryland Morning. Stay with us.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Holidays will soon be upon us, and for many folks, that means a chance or two to dress up and enjoy a few parties and some special meals with family and friends. What's the best way to approach the often daunting task of putting together that special outfit for those special occasions? Maybe more than a few of us have a little fashion phobia when it comes to staying stylish on a budget in a world where the range of styles one sees out and about runs a very, very large gamut. Sloan Brown joins me in the studio. Sloan keeps a keen eye out for what people are wearing to various events around town, and I thought it'd be good to check in with her for some advice on how to take the fear out of fashion as we gear up for the holidays. Sloan is the society and style reporter for the Baltimore Sun, where she writes the columns called Seen and Heard and Glimpsed. Hey, Sloan, how you doing?
Good.
So happy holidays.
You too.
So fashion really can be intimidating for some folks. When you talk to folks about that issue, what are the common things that you hear people saying that they worry about?
I think what people are most afraid of is looking foolish. And
something I have a lot of experience in.
Well, don't we all? you know, so I think a lot of people are afraid of trying something new because they're afraid they'll look silly. And I think particularly when you get older, then there's that fear of, oh, I don't want somebody thinking that I'm looking like I'm trying to be too young and therefore foolish.
Yeah.
Which is a shame because fashion is, you know, for me, is so much fun.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the whole point of it. I mean, fashion is one of the great self-curating things we do about
ourselves. Yes, it's a great form of self-expression, and everybody can do it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just kind of, I'm going to sound like a self-help expert, but it's a way of embracing, you know, who you are and having a little fun with it instead of letting it be so intimidating.
Yeah, because it's not just how you look to the outside world. It's how you look to
yourself. Yeah. That's the first person you need to impress is the person that you look in the mirror.
Because, I mean, we all know that, you know, feeling of you buy a new suit or a new dress and you put it on for the first time and it just
feels great
and, you know, you feel better.
But then there's also that time, too, that I think everybody's experience, and I think this is what often holds people back, is that, you know, somebody's bought that new suit or particularly new dress, they put it on, and all of a sudden they're racked with doubt. Like, oh, I don't know, maybe this wasn't the right thing. Now, you know, what happens? And that's what, you know, you're kind of talking to yourself.
Sometimes people have a shopping phobia, too. It's not just a fashion phobia. It's a shopping phobia.
Oh, sure.
So when folks go to stores, what's your advice for folks to, you know, keep them on an even keel and not let them get too worked up about this?
Well, I think the first place you ought to do, if I'm going to sound like a fashion shrink here, is start actually before you go shopping, start in your closet. And I think particularly for women, I don't know, at some point I think all of us play dress-ups at some point. And I think a lot of us lost that kind of joy. And maybe spend an afternoon on a weekend or whatever having fun in your closet, you know, exploring what you've got, trying on things again, trying to combine things. And it's just you trying it on the mirror and starting to, you know, kind of like, oh, wow, those two things would go together. And when you start to kind of feel a little bit of that, it's also going to make it easier to go to a store. And I think especially if you've got kind of a shopping phobia that way, go with a good girlfriend where the two of you are going to have some fun. And again, you know, make it like a weekend afternoon or something. If you need a little liquid courage, have a glass of wine at lunch and then just go have some fun. Play around in the dressing rooms and giggle and you know what? Try on some stuff. And if it's foolish, you kind of laugh with each other. But you may also put on something and go, wow, this really makes me feel good. And you get that feeling again that you had from way back when you were playing dress-ups. And that's actually, it's a really great feeling.
Yeah, and of course, the men from Mars and the women from Venus. Right. This is not the kind of thing guys generally do.
No, I can't imagine guys going...
If anyone called me up and said, you want to go shopping, you want to go to Joseph A. Banks and buy a suit, you know, that wouldn't happen. But this is it can be a bonding thing for women. It can be fun. And then when you get there...
And you get backup, too. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So when you get there... What do you do? How do you approach the store when you walk in?
Just start combing the racks. I mean, I pulling stuff and if there's something that you kind of think is kind of cute, but you might ordinarily say, oh, that's really cute, but that's not really me. You know, you're just trying it on. Pull it out, try it on, find out if maybe it is you. You know, maybe there's, and especially if you're incorporating, you know, when you're creating outfits, you're incorporating several pieces. So you don't have to do everything all new that's out of the box for you. You can incorporate one piece that might be pushing it a little bit, combining that, you know, say a new blouse or something with a skirt that you feel, you know, that's kind of a safety for you.
So it is important to try stuff on that you might normally not be inclined to wear.
Yeah.
You just want to sort
just
of see
it on.
This takes a lot of time, doesn't it?
Well,
you've got to really invest you've got to allocate a fair chunk of time to do this.
You know, but I think sometimes you can have some real revelations just in an afternoon, you know, and it's not something, and the whole point of this is that it should be fun. You don't want to start making this as if, oh, I have to do this every Saturday or, you know, I think you can rediscover the fun. Mm-hmm. And even if you just come away from one afternoon with a couple of ideas or a couple of fun accessories that now you've got to kind of liven up what you've got, I think you're going to, you know, you end up feeling a lot better.
And the buddy you take maybe is a person who doesn't have the same kind of style
so you can
inclinations
push each other.
That you do.
That's often a good thing to do, too. You can kind of push each other.
So I understand there are a couple of trends
that
we're going to, we should be hip to for this. And one of them is fringe.
Fringe is very big.
I had no idea.
You'll see it all over the place. You've got fringe on all sorts of boots, skirts, jackets, and it's in varying degrees. So again, if you're kind of just tentatively stepping outside your box, you might want to find something that's got, you know, just a small, you know, a little fringe on the bottom of a skirt or something like that that makes you feel like you're hip, but you're not having to like go way to the extreme. And there are lots of great fringy things.
So you can dip the toes in the water a little
bit.
It's not like you have to just sort of put fringe on every
both
elbows, both knees, you know, and a headdress.
Particularly when you're doing kind of one of these strong trends. When you're going to use, you know, and kind of incorporate a trend, just go with that one. Don't try to then throw a whole lot of other things with it.
Yeah.
Because then it starts to look a little wackadoodle.
And some of these high-priced fashion stores, these boutique-y places, they actually do have sales.
Oh, yeah.
Open, right? So, I mean, it's not
big
like
time.
You should definitely discount them and just, oh, that's
no,
out of my league financially.
But you can also go to some of the big chain stores that are, you know, are now kind of referred to as fast fashion. You know, it's inexpensive things. And often they look as if they're really geared towards the very young. And actually, you can find some great kind of trendy things there. Another couple of strong trends to look for, particularly if you're trying to kind of update your holiday look, fur accessories. And there's great faux fur all over the place. So it doesn't need to be the real thing, and it doesn't need to be expensive.
And that's a new thing for this year, fringe and
well,
fur.
Well, yeah, fur has been kind of growing in popularity. But you can find it, as you know, with touches. On accessories, you don't have to go completely wacky. And boots are really strong, over the knee boots. If you're feeling a little adventuresome, that might be a way to have a little fun this year.
All right. Well, good advice. We appreciate it. We shall see you again soon. Appreciate it.
You bet.
Sloan Brown is the Society and Style reporter for Baltimore Sun. She writes the Seen and Heard and Glimpsed columns in the paper. We've got a link to those columns on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today here on Maryland Morning. Nathan Sterner co-hosts, directs, and engineers the program. Rob Sivak, Jonna McCone, and Kathleen Cahill produce it with assistance from Scott Seiss. Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville keeps us caffeinated. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. And thanks to Chris Kennedy and Clean Cuts Music for our theme song, and a reminder that we're asking for your feedback about some possibilities for new theme music. Remember to visit our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Listen to the 5 possibilities that the composers at Clean Cuts have offered us, and let us know which one you like the best. Hope you can join us Monday morning on Maryland Morning. Until then, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.